Will the committee on the Sal Special Committee on the Exxon Valdez, good afternoon, will the House Committee, Special Committee on the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Claim Settlement, please come to order? It is now 10 after 12 on Friday, April 5. We have members of the committee here, Representative Hudson, Representative Davidson, and myself, Max Bruenberg. We also have Representative Carney, who is with us. We have the Attorney General, Charles Cole, who will join us in just a minute. But before he does, I'd like to ask Greg Erickson of our staff to just address the committee for a minute. Mr. Erickson told me a few things that I found important and interesting. Before we hear from Mr. Cole, I'd like Mr. Erickson to talk with us just for a minute so that the members can have the benefit of his comments, and they may lead to questions by Mr. Cole. I was going to have Mr. Erickson speak second, but this may lead to questioning of Mr. Cole. So Mr. Erickson, and flip your toggle switch up, we're on teleconference today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Greg Erickson. I'm an economic consultant retained by the committee. Mr. Chairman, there is in front of yourself, I believe, and the members, a copy of a memorandum dated April 5th from myself to you. I would direct your attention to the page 4 of that memorandum and the question related to restitution. At that point, the question arose as to what sort of things the $50 million that might be spent on, or that we may receive in restitution under the criminal plea agreement, might be spent on. And in addition, what might, although it's not addressed here, a similar question arises with respect to the funds received for restoration under the consent decree and to be allocated in accordance with the memorandum of agreement between the state and federal governments. As I note on page 4 in the answer to that restitution question, there is language in the definition of restoration in the criminal plea agreement, and there is similar language in the consent decree that substantially broadens the objects, at least in my opinion, substantially broadens the objects upon which those funds can be spent. That language relates to the enhancement of affected resources. Now, restoration usually is defined, and is defined in the federal acts, as direct restoration, replacement, and acquisition of equivalent resources. The enhancement language is nowhere found in federal statute that I'm aware of. The first place I saw the enhancement language was in a draft memorandum of agreement that was circulated by the federal government to the state in December, which was, in my opinion, designed to appeal to the new governor's interest in building a road to Cordova. That was the prevalent opinion, I should say, and it indeed may have some other purpose. I think it's important that the committee be aware of this, particularly in light of the assertions by the administration that the funds under the consent decree that will go for restoration are not subject to appropriation. Because if that is the case, the objects of that money that is to be discretionarily allocated by the trustees, state and federal trustees, is much broader than it would have been had that language not been included. And that was the main point. Mr. Chairman, it may also be of some relevance, and you asked me to mention this, that and these are hearsay comments, I guess, but I think they're things that maybe the committee might want to delve into a little more deeply. I understand that a trustee council meeting last week by teleconference, that Commissioner Sandor indicated, who is a member of the trustee council and has been designated by Governor Hickel as a trustee in this issue, indicated to his federal colleagues on the trustee council that it was his desire to suspend the damage assessment studies and to suspend the restoration science studies on the grounds that they are perhaps no longer necessary. It's also my understanding that the federal members of the trustee council demurred from that view, and that a meeting was held yesterday to deal with those issues, and they may have been resolved by now. But I think it is of considerable interest if the administration does indeed intend to continue or not continue the damage assessment and restoration planning studies. There's some suggestion that the administration's desire here is to establish a Prince William Sound Park and an endowment, and that there is, in fact, no need for the science studies to support those particular objects of restoration work. Again, I emphasize that these are hearsay. I cannot vouch for what did occur at that meeting. I was not there, but I think the sources I consulted were quite reliable.
And you indicated that a lead trustee has been established tentatively?
It has been suggested both among the state and federal participants that the intention of the state is to establish the Department of Natural Resources as the lead trustee. That, too, of course, is a subject that the administration might be queried on.
And that would be Commissioner Harold Hines?
Yes, as soon as the criminal and other as soon as this agreement is in place. I think there was concern that because of Commissioner Heintz's relationship to ARCO, which was a participant in the Alaska Pipeline Company, that it would have been inappropriate to involve him in this matter before the while there was still pending the civil and criminal litigation.
Does that lead to questions on the part of the committee here? I wanted to get that on the record before we had Attorney General Cole. I'd like to welcome Representative Finkelstein in the meeting. Representative Hudson.
Is the, I'm trying to recollect now, Greg, it's either the commissioner or his designee, is that correct? In the language?
I'm not sure which language you're...
I'm thinking about the proposed agreement that we have.
Proposed agreement that we have here...
Or designees?
I think it indicates that the commissioners of those departments or any other individuals that the governor may choose to designate.
Oh, I see. That's what I was trying to get to.
Any other questions? Mr. Erickson, thank you very much. Is Mr. Cole outside there?
He mentioned he'd be right back.
You can just stand at ease for a minute. Before we start, actually, are there any questions of any committee member for any member of the staff? We'll stand at ease for a minute. Cliff, did you hear what he said about suspending your studies?
Well, it's the information I received was that Mr. Sanders well, I can only speculate or pass on the speculation of the people who were talking about the federal officials. Speculation.
The time is now 25 after 12, and Attorney General Call has joined us. I'd like the record to reflect we have Representative Barnes with us as well.
Aye.
Attorney General Cole, we were in the process of continuing questioning on you, your questioning, and we're dealing with the consent decree. We had completed the questions we have gotten through question number 7, and we were about to continue. But before we continue with the questioning, with question number 8, I'm wondering if any committee member has anything that they would like to ask based on the material that was already covered, or for that matter, anything that Mr. Erickson said before us today. I'd like the record to reflect what we've been joined by Representative Kabir. Well, Representative Davidson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Attorney General, we've talked a little bit about the extent of the assessment of damages, but what is the intent of the state at this point? Are we going to continue the assessment of damages and the entries? And would there be cause to do that? Or do you have any idea how we as a state are going to proceed?
Yes.
And let me say this. In order to supply the committee with that which I think is a fair evaluation, it's first necessary for me to comment on Mr. Erickson's testimony, which I had the opportunity to hear a portion of this morning. Mr. Sandor, after discussing the future of the expenditure of funds realized from the settlement, if it's finally approved, were of the view that in light of the settlement, a reassessment of the studies during 1991 should be made with a view to determining which studies, in light of the settlement, could be eliminated. It seemed eminently sound judgment to make that reassessment at this time. A particular discussion were certain economic studies which had been initiated in furtherance of the state's claims for damages against Exxon. Underlying these discussions was the view that as much money as possible should be utilized for restoration purposes rather than perhaps singular scientific knowledge. That was the central thrust of Mr. Sandor's and mine and Mr. Rozier's discussion. And those were the views which he presented yesterday, 11:40 or 10:40, to the trustee council. That was a meeting which I had the opportunity to attend part of. There is planned to be expended this summer in continuing studies and related expenditures approximately $35 million. Commissioner Sandor and Commissioner Rozier and I want to make certain that those studies are in furtherance of damage assessment and restoration. And I think that that approach is eminently called for at this time. There is, if you will recall, a covenant in the agreement to continue the 1991 scientific studies. State trustees have no intention of breaching or endeavoring to thwart that provision of the agreement. You see, if one thinks about this recovery and how it's most effectively utilized, one has to draw a careful line between how much money is really expended for damage assessment and the ability and wisdom of enhancing and restoring the damage once the assessment process has been completed. The the damage assessment process can consume tens of millions of dollars over a lengthy period of time, and the call has to be made as to where is the cut. Now, the federal and state representatives at the meeting yesterday said that periodically that review has been undertaken by the council, and that it began as early as November and has continued, and that there has been a weeding out of certain of the studies by the scientists and the council. That's my response to that question. If there are further questions, let me say this. Like I said, you know, it would be nice if public officials were at least given the presumption of good faith and a sense of integrity. Commissioner Sandor and I and Commissioner Rozier and Governor Hickel have no secret agenda. Our view in the negotiating process was to achieve the greatest realizable sum which could be obtained to restore Prince William Sound and the injured natural resources. And we want to set about restoring those injured natural resources. And nobody among the state trustees, to my knowledge, has any secret intent to do other than precisely that. Nobody has mentioned building roads or exotic concrete and steel improvements. Just restore damaged resources.
Representative Davidson.
Mr. Cole, I appreciate your comments and certainly that's part of the territory when you're serving in the public. But you know, I would have a little more level of comfort with some of your efforts as the trustees if you made wider reference to the extent of the damages. Frequently, it seems that we're concentrating only on Prince William Sound. And frankly, I'm nervous for Kodiak and other areas that were affected by the spill.
I saw that one coming. Look, if you will look at the language of the agreement, it's referred to as spill-affected areas. We certainly had your constituency and what other westward natural resources in mind when we negotiated that agreement. And I see, is that the pink book there, the so-called pink book? That contains, ladies and gentlemen, complete, detailed, 150-some pages analysis of proposed studies and expenditures of $35 million. If anyone on this committee or anyone in the legislature or anyone in the world has objections to those proposed expenditures, they're now open for public comment in the Federal Registry. What more could be done?
Mr. Cole, I'm sorry, we're going to have a lot of questions, and I'm going to ask everybody to keep their questions brief and the answers to the point if we can. Representative Davis,
just a single very quick answer, very quick question. Will the meetings of the trustees be open to the public, all or any, or just some?
I don't really know the answer to that question because I've not discussed the subject with the other trustees, and I wouldn't want to be presumptuous of stating their position. I can tell you my personal opinion is that they should be open to the public. And let me say another thing, as long as we're on the subject, we provided in that agreement for the formulation of why advisory group, and I think it's appropriate at this time, as I suggested yesterday, that the trustees get together and decide what the future organizational structure of the trustee group, the six trustee group, and its administrative organization will be. Yesterday, and let me say, there were 40 people, or no, there were 20 people, in addition to the three state trustees yesterday, present. Okay. I think there were another 15 or 20 attending by telephone conference in Anchorage. And I think that maybe it's necessary to take a look at that structure as we proceed, if this settlement is approved, and maybe streamline the organization a little bit. Those were only the people that you might say I counted. I don't know how many more exist in Washington, D.C., but it seems to me that the present structure is a little overloaded. Thank you.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Attorney General, I had just received and had gone through last night the double volume pink plan that, as you indicated, is subject to open right now for public review. So I was rather surprised to hear that maybe all of a sudden we were changing that. But if I understand, and I want to make sure that I understand, mm-hmm. your testimony is that if there are any changes, it will be more to pursue restoration as opposed to, say, litigation, assuming at any rate that if this is approved, that some of the ongoing tester evaluation, economic considerations might not be necessary if we have an approval of this nature. Is that a fair assessment?
That's precisely accurate.
Right, thank you.
And I want to say one more note if I can. See, we asked for public comment in this document, and we're in good faith about the receipt of public comment. And if we didn't say we had an open mind at this time about what we received from the public comment, in my view, we would be acting irresponsibly. I mean, we can't say right now, well, we have all these studies fixed in concrete, because we're asking for public comment, and we want public comment. And if we receive a public comment, which is on the mark, so to speak, it can cause us to change our mind. That's the system. I think it worked. Thank you.
I have a question. Any other members of on this point? I am a little bit concerned, Mr. Attorney General, about one aspect. You indicated that we need to have faith in you folks to do your job. I think that that's a two-way street, you need to have faith in us and keep us informed, the public informed, that when we hear statements that studies are being suspended right in this crucial time, that is bound to have far-reaching effects, particularly when we don't receive it directly from you, but we mm-hmm. receive it indirectly from third parties who just leaked the word out. That doesn't help in our confidence in the process and leads to a question that this committee is going to have to address, and it hasn't been addressed so far. But I want the committee members to be thinking of it. I know Congress is considering it, and that is what kind of legislative oversight there should be on this process if the agreement is approved in whole or part and the process proceeds. What type of continuing legislative oversight should there be, and should this legislature consider the enactment of legislation requiring that? I'm sort of just throwing that out. I'm not asking for a response from anyone. I don't want to get off track at the moment, but
well, let me respond to that if you don't mind. I don't really wish to be argumentative, but
please.
I'd like to say here is this group which has been functioning for 2 years, 20, 40 people, functioning carefully and judiciously, and making decisions as the process goes on, weekly, monthly. I mean, if the legislature wants to send somebody over there and attend all those meetings, I'm certainly there would be welcome. But it's very difficult to have these people exercising their administrative responsibilities come and make decisions and exercise judgment, and then we hear here, well, this is leaked out. Nobody's leaking out anything. People are doing the same thing they've been doing for the last 2 years. And if this were a matter of legislative concern, you would think that for the past 2 years, when the legislature was appropriating these funds, that it would have the oversight that it now speaks about having, attending all these committees. What's been going on for the last 2 years? All I know what's been going on now, and suddenly there's almost this presumption of secretiveness. And I just find it hard to accept, gentlemen. I mean, I don't mean to be argumentative about it, but, you know.
Representative Finkelstein.
Well, I just think you're maybe reacting to things out of context. The only thing that's occurred here earlier today was we did have a hearsay report on a meeting because we didn't have someone there. It isn't clear, based on one of the questions before, whether that meeting was even open. But apart from that, we only hear hearsay when we don't have firsthand reports. And we really appreciate your filling us in and giving us the you know, what's actually going on. I mean, there was no implication in any of that any of that was correct. All, you know, I didn't assume it to be correct. It was just something we were hearing third hand. That's the only element that was going on. And as for the legislature's oversight, we don't generally sit in and host these meetings. You're right. The role we play is we look at the fish and game budget, we look at some of the studies, the special appropriations we made, and we fund them. Every one of us who was there had to vote on those, you know, along the way. That's our role. We aren't, you know, I think you're maybe expecting too much that we'd be sitting in on all the meetings in the meantime.
Let me just say, if you want information, please ask for it. We'd be pleased to give it to you.
Any other questions at this point? If not, why don't we take up where we left off last time? We were at question number 8 on the consent decree. And what did the terms in the first 3 lines on page 6 of the consent decree mean? Does natural resource damage include economic loss to the state?
I have just a minute. I'm trying to find the correct one. I have so many questions here that I get confused between the first and second set from the Senate and set from the House here. Number is this now?
Number eight. The first eight.
Is that under the consent decree?
Yeah.
Well, this must be the Senate group. May I just number 8? See, that's the one I have, but that's not the right one, I think.
Let me see this.
Well, that was crossed out in my copy. I'm sorry. That's one that you said I wouldn't be asked about, so I didn't bother to...
I'm sorry.
Isn't that right?
Okay, so that was not yours. Okay.
It had an X there, and that's why I didn't read the number.
I see. Okay. My fault for asking the wrong question. The wrong answer. Let's look at question number 9. What impact does the agreement have on the state's rights and legal position prior to a final approval, but after the effective date?
The only operative effect, which I can think of, has to do with Exxon's obligation to continue with cleanup activities prior to final approval. We thought, you know, that final approval may involve appeals, things of that nature, and who knows when they'll be resolved. But I think that's the most singularly effective provision.
and I may be skipping ahead, Mr. Attorney General, but I'd like the members to refer to paragraphs 11 and 12 of the CD. That's at pages 11 through 13. And we were informed by our counsel that those paragraphs are immediately effective and cannot be terminated or modified. Is that correct? Is the state, as much as legally possible, bound by those, in your opinion?
Can you give me those again now?
Paragraphs 11 and 12, pages 13, pages 11 and following. I'm on the CD, of course.
Yes, but you know, you'll recall that paragraph 12 has provisions for recapturing the status quo, as it were, if the agreement is not approved, and that is the reason for paragraph 12, is to cover the possibility that Exxon may initiate spill cleanup, may expend funds, and then there be no approval by legislature or by the court, then what happens? This is subject to big discussion, and it was hard to devise, a remedial provision to cover that contingency.
I understand, and we'll get to that in a minute. It's my intent that as we pass on each question, I'm not going to ask the committee members each time, but please just raise your hand if you have any questions on that particular provision, so we'll move right along. Next, we have question 14, use of the money dealing with paragraph 10, which, of course, is found here on page 10. Article 9, section 7 of the Alaska Constitution prohibits dedicating of funds. Money received under the Clean Water Act must be designated as reflected in this paragraph. Can you, Mr. Attorney General, choose to settle a case under a law that requires a dedicated fund, especially when the state could recover under state law, and that federal law does not require dedication? I'm sorry, the state law does not require or allow dedication. Is recovery under the CWA participation in a, quote, federal program, unquote, such that the prohibition against dedicated funds in our Constitution would not apply? And I know Representative Barnes is smiling and nodding. This is her question.
Here's the answer. As best as I can formulate it.
For those of us who are slow readers, or worse yet, haven't read it at all, why don't you tell us what the answer is?
Well, I think the answer is, yes, to both questions.
Would you care to be a little more
lengthy? This is the elaboration.
We appreciate the brevity, if not the clarity.
Well, I mean, here's the question. Can the Attorney General choose to settle a case under a law that requires a dedicated fund? Then there's this word, especially, when the state could recover under state law, which does not require dedication. And I don't mean to be evasive, but it's simply my view, for the reasons stated in that opinion, that the Attorney General can do that. And you know, there's a lot of authority there, and I realize full well that I had to make a decision, the governor and I, as to how to make this settlement work. And I realize that. You know, the governor and I and the lawyers who spent untold weeks and hours putting this together had to make decisions and did make decisions to reach a settlement and a successful settlement. When you adopt legislation, you work towards getting it done. And we'd never have concluded this settlement if I had sat there and the 15 government lawyers which participated in the negotiations on behalf of the two governments had said, look at all these problems, what are we going to do with them? And I had that in my own staff. Believe me, I said we're going to make some calls and we're going to resolve the problems. I mean, that's all I can say. I studied that question carefully. I concluded that the Attorney General had that power. I concluded that it was in the best interest of the state, and that was that. Did I realize that somebody could stay here today? Did you have that power? Sure I did. Of course I did. But I just thought that we have to get this money back so we can get on with restoring the sound. And it was in the state's interest to do that, and that's why I did.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Other members have questions. I see the representative putting on her glasses.
I'm going to pass because my questions would be far too lengthy.
I why stop now? I mean, you know.
Well, you have to admit it's a very well put question.
Of course I do. Is there
otherwise, I wouldn't have a document this long to answer it.
Of course, it's a central question, and I realize that.
To me, Mr. Chairman, if I may, Mr. Attorney General, I want to say that I do appreciate all the work that the administration has put into this settlement. But to me, the fundamental question that must be answered as it relates to the settlement is, first of all, did you settle it based on a state's asset? And if you did settle it based on a state's asset, does then the settlement not become a state asset? And if it does become a state asset, then only the legislature has the power to appropriate those funds in which you have negotiated the settlement. And therein lies my problem. If we, and only we, the legislature, under Section 9, Article 9, Section 13 of the Constitution, sets out that only the legislature may appropriate, then how in the world can we get from the legislature to three persons from the state, three from the federal government, and a federal judge making those appropriations on behalf of the state?
Under a federal statute, which is the supreme law of the land.
So then the answer to my question is that the Clean Water Act supersedes our Constitution.
Well, I don't think it supersedes the Constitution, because I think under the Clean Water Act that those assets, you know, the right of recovery under the Clean Water Act for state trustees is not coming to the state treasury.
It's very interesting.
Well, I thought so.
I'm not sure I'd buy that, but I'll have to think on it a little more. So I have to come back at you.
Well,
I'm not an attorney. You are, so.
But you have first-rate lawyers and staff, and I put it in writing in 31 pages, and I'm prepared to stand behind that. Like I said the other day, is there a possibility with someone sitting up there with a black robe on might come to a different conclusion? Sure, happens all the time. Like I said the other day, you have greater predictability going to the corner bar and rolling dice than you do going before the court. At least that's been my experience. It doesn't say much for my legal abilities, but nonetheless, I mean, that's my view, and I acted under it. And when you're there, on the firing line, you have to make these calls. And as you know, as a legislator, you just can't sit there and be in a dither and say, you know, I wonder what's going to happen. I mean, you know, the dynamics of the day and the legislative process and negotiating process require decisions. And so I made them.
Mr. Attorney General, you are, I'm told, a very reputable attorney. But there is a difference in you making that deal and this committee and these legislators. And we are held accountable at the ballot box for the decisions we make. And we're held accountable by the oath that we swear when we're sworn in to uphold the Constitution of the state of Alaska. And my thoughts are that while you need to be commended for the work and some on the settlement, I must say that in my own mind, that because this is a settlement based on damage to an asset of the state, even though it was settled under the Clean Water Act, that there has to be some way that this legislature, if it is a settlement that belongs to the state of Alaska, any portion of it, it has to then be appropriated by this legislature. I don't know how you reach it, but I believe for it to be legal and binding that it must.
If you feel that way, you should vote against this settlement agreement. And if enough people in the legislature feel with you, agree with you on that issue, I mean, we'll terminate the agreement and pick up our papers and go home and start the litigation anew. That's all I can say. That is the choice I face. That is the choice you face. And if you don't agree with the decision, the governor and me, I mean, there's no hard feelings. I'm not out flogging this settlement. It's the best we could do. I mean, if it's not satisfactory, it should be voted down by the people. But I thought it was. And also, I didn't want to walk away. I didn't feel it was my responsibility as a public resource trustee acting in behalf of the state to walk away from $1 billion. I wasn't going to make that decision. I thought that it was a good settlement. I thought it was in the public interest. But I was perfectly prepared to commit that final decision to the legislature. And that's where we are.
Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Attorney General, I can recognize certainly the position that you were in when you were looking at $1 billion. And I understand that the initial figure had been $1.2 billion that the governor put forth. All I'm saying is that there must be some way within this process that constitutionally we can reach the appropriation process. If it is a state asset, if you tell me that it is not a state asset, then I will fold up my camel's tent and walk away. But if you tell me that it is a state asset, the Supreme Court in Byrne versus State and others, and the Homestead Act of 1978 ruled very clearly that only the legislature, including land or any other assets, has the right to appropriate. That is standing law of the land. And until such time that you can prove to me that this is not an asset, I've got a constitutional problem.
I can't prove it to you in those 31 pages. I can't prove it to you.
Okay.
But I don't think it's a state asset in that sense. Thanks. And, well, number one. And number two, to the extent it may be, I think it's within the Constitution.
Thank you.
Okay, questions by other members of the committee. I have Representative Hudson, and then I have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to just follow on the same line of questioning that my good friend and representative from Anchorage followed on, and refer to the memorandum from Pam Finley to Senator Sam Cotton concerning essentially the same element. And I think therein lies the problem for at least people like myself who are not attorneys, in trying to deal with this, because if you look on the second page of that particular document, you can almost find the same reasoning that providing the money was not had to be used for specified, in this particular case, the court upheld that the proceeds of a settlement between Chevron and the Federal Department of Energy had to be used for specified purposes, were not subject to appropriation by the Colorado legislature. Reasoned that the money was not subject to appropriation either because it was in trust from a private source or because it was from a federal source with restrictions placed on its use. Now, there's some other stipulations that I'm sure attorneys can argue about, but you see, I think that's what we're dealing with here. The Attorney General has given us a multi-page memorandum of his constructive belief of why this is not necessarily has to be subject to appropriation. And we also have from our own sources, at any rate, by copy to this committee, a similar decision here, and I don't know how we're going to solve this. Maybe we'll go and find a third attorney, but that's the dilemma that we're facing here, and I think this is really the crux of the issue of whether or not and what power not only this legislature but future legislatures can have. So I think it's a very critical issue, and I hope we can, you know, we can, Mr. Attorney General, I hope we can have you take a look at this. I'm sure you already have as well, Henry, but to see if you can help folks like myself, at any rate, to understand better where in the you know, if there is any escape clause or any outlet in the whole thing. Because one, which we all should have a copy of. And I just read the pertinent parts.
Mr. Attorney General, it appears that there are going to be some follow-up actions that may possibly be necessary. Is there any reason that this settlement could not have included a requirement that the legislature must appropriate the necessary money to the trust fund each year?
Yes.
And what was the reason?
Well, look at the general setting which we have. We have federal funds thrown into the pot to avoid interminable litigation between the state and federal government as to who owns which natural resource damage recovery. Do you think that the United States of America is going to stand by and say, we will grant to the legislature of the state of Alaska the power to control these lumped together funds? I submit that there is not one chance in a million that that could ever occur. The Congress of the United States, which itself, don't forget, is not saying that it has to appropriate these funds every year, is going to suddenly say, all right, well, we'll let the Alaska legislature decide how to expend these funds. Not going to happen, I tell you.
Did you ever discuss with the federal negotiators a possible split? Did you ever make an offer how this, how these damages could be apportioned on a percentage basis?
Did I make him an offer?
Discuss it. I'm not quibbling over what. Did you
ever
discuss it?
Well, I'm not either, but I'm trying to figure out. I think it's very fair and accurate to say there was no possible way which could have led to a segregation of those funds.
My question again, sir. Did you ever broach the subject and bring it up to him?
What, precisely?
Whether the damages could be apportioned. You seem to have settled everything else. I have yet to hear whether or not this was even discussed. Whether you
It had been discussed for 18 months, to tell you the truth.
Did you ever, in the course of those negotiations earlier this year?
Wait a minute. That had been discussed for some 18 months through the Cooper administration. This wasn't an original thought with me. Okay?
My question again.
Just a minute, please. Let me finish my answer. It had been discussed by the Cooper administration and Attorney General Bailey for months and months, and there had been documents which reflected the joint consolidation of whatever rights the state had and whatever rights the feds had. Did I ever sit down with Assistant Attorney General Richard B. Stewart and say, let's talk about splitting up these recoveries? I think a fair answer to that is no, because I realized that it was so impossible. It's like me taking a rocket to the moon tomorrow. I really don't talk about it because I realize that it's simply impossible. That was my process of thinking.
Representative Cabina.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Attorney General, this is probably one area that I'm quite sympathetic with you on, because I've seen legislators trying to think of ways to divvy up this money in their own ways, and that frankly scares me, because I think it should be dedicated to a single purpose. And Mr. Chairman, at some point I would like the Attorney General to discuss in more detail how he sees that process to happen, how
maybe the limitations that you see on money. I know the document speaks to it somewhat, but really your interpretation, you say it can't be for roads, but can it be for trees, can it be for fish? You know, at some point do you say to yourself 2-3 years down the line that we have done all we can to help recover, to help the beaches, to help the kelp? What do we do those last 5 years if there's nothing specifically like that related? Where would you go with $70 million a year? I'd like some discussion of that issue if you think it's appropriate time or whenever, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Attorney General, you're certainly welcome to answer that now. I'd like the record to reflect the Representative Namar's here.
Good afternoon, sir.
The record should reflect they're both smiling. Please, do you wish to answer that now or do you want us to take it later?
Well, let me just think about it a little bit. You know, I want to say preliminarily that not only under the Clean Water Act, in my view, are these funds dedicated, but I think under the concept of the common law, public trustee concept, following that theory through, that the funds would be required to be dedicated. I've thought about it a lot. I mean, this isn't something that, you know, I just get up in the morning and go down and when I sit down at my desk, I start thinking about this. I think about it for endless hours. And I've thought that if this money had come into the state treasury under a state public resource theory based on the common law, that it would have to be used in furtherance of the restoring of the damaged resources. I mean, I've never really studied that, but, you know, I wing a lot of this law I practice, but it seems to me that it would be improper to recover money for damaged salmon resources in Kodiak area and spend them to build the airport at Barrow. You see, I think that the common law itself provides those restrictions. And so that if this money, say, were a state asset, came in the state treasury, that at the end of the day it would have to be used, quote, by the legislature, close quote, in the same way that it's going to be used there. Of course, perhaps under that theory, the legislature would have a little more control under the various projects. But if you think about the political process, which I've thought about and how this will operate, the trustees are appointed by the governor, state trustees under the Clean Water Act, certainly of all people, of all groups who have political power, as it were, the respective leaders in the House and Senate would go to the governor and say, look, governor, I mean, this guy Cole is off base, and he's not looking after my resources up there in Valdez or so forth, and we want to have a word with you about it. See, so, I mean, that's, or Governor Cooper, or whom have you. So, I mean, the process will work. I mean, this is not some state trustees who have, like federal judges who have a lifetime, you know, commitment and says, don't bother me, in a sense. I mean, these are some political appointees, and they're going to be a minimal, I'm sure, to the will of the political process. So, I mean, you know, with that background, I sort of want to start with that premise now. These federal trustees like Dr. Knaus, world-renowned scientists, and they have a very dedicated interest in the scientific studies of the damaged areas and the restoration of those damaged resources. And I know the general counsel of NOAA, Tom Campbell. I mean, you know, he was after me so forcefully, urging me to throw the state $72 million into the trust so it could be used for restoration of the sound. Well, the state did not agree with that. For that reason, it's in there. I can't really say all of those projects which will be used, which will be initiated by the trustees, but we're going to have, I think, mayors of the various affected communities, municipalities on this committee. We're going to have scientists, we're going to have native groups, we're going to have environmental groups, we're going to have a broad base who will furnish their views on the best use of those funds to the trustees. And I'm satisfied that these trustees will act responsibly. And if they don't, someone should simply go to the governor and say, get this guy off there. I mean, he's thwarting what ought to be done. So I think the system will work. That's a loose answer to your question.
Thank you, sir. Did that complete your question?
That's fine.
Representative.
I just want to follow up, Mr. Attorney General. I think that actually is a fairly simplistic way of suggesting that someone might have influence over the governor. Maybe if you could get enough people upset enough that one of the trustees, if you even had access to know what the trustees were doing, someone might have the ability to say get rid of a particular trustee or do something differently. But it certainly is not going to be as simple as you suggest. Someone go to the governor and tell him to get this guy off there.
Oh, I think the legislature says, by the way, governor, we want to add $50 million to the education budget. Those things have a way of working, as I read the papers. So, I certainly think that the political process works reasonably well. But that's, you're far more experienced in the world of politics than I don't claim to be at all there, but I sort of look around and see that it works reasonably well.
Thank you. I'd like to welcome Representative Lincoln. We have more questions by Representative Barr than Representative Woodson.
Just a comment, and you're far more knowledgeable about the area of law than I am.
Thanks.
Yeah. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Attorney General, one of the earlier questions I had about this whole thing, after I realized how it was set up and where the monies were dedicated for, and seeing the relationship between dedicating any funds recovered essentially to restore what had been damaged. Personally, I thought that was a very clever and a pretty damn ingenious way of dealing with things. When we were asked to approve this whole thing, one of the questions I asked Mr. Chairman there, I think it's in one of our questions here, is whether or not we could approve with stipulations. And it seems to me like one element that perhaps would be amenable by all parties, even before finalization, would be to place at least an advice and consent of the legislative body into whatever final expenditures or programs have been developed. The idea there being that we could bring a lot of resources to seeing that the decisions on expenditure are made with, good prudent background and judgment. And I just throw that out as a question as to whether or not you think that an agreement with stipulations, for example, or a stipulation of that nature, would it be totally impossible to take that back to the table, for example?
Let me answer as follows. I think it would be fruitless to take it back, number one. And number two is the legislature commits widely to administrative bodies throughout the state, the adoption of regulations, other projects, does it all the time. And this strikes me as not being so far afield of that. which the legislature repeatedly and for years has historically done with respect to administrative bodies. Take, for example, the Department of Education. I mean, look what the Department of Education, these boards of education, do to one of the very most, you know, basic, let's say, resources we have in the state, the education of our children. Far more important, I should think, than Prince William Sound natural resource damage. And does the legislature micromanage that? I don't think so. So that's the thought. Then the next thought I have in that regard is that how much time do you really want to spend reading that book? And that's just one little year's project. That's a concise summary of what projects they intend to do. Underlying that, there's this much information, background supporting the reasons for going ahead with those projects. And there's page after page after page of documents by number 13, you know, says, I don't think we should do this, I think we should cut it off. Number 17 says, let's do it. I mean, so for the legislature to really effectively do anything, it's a massive job.
Mr. Attorney General, if I might follow up. I don't think that's, at least that's not what I had anticipated. I believe, practically speaking, the implementation of this massive multi-year project will at times embody the need to change the statutes, perhaps, which is a legislative function. There will be projects that will be one to undertake, and what I'm suggesting is that it would be constructive to the trustees, and I think probably more amenable, at least making the legislature, who represent all the people of Alaska, feel like they're somewhat into the process, if there was some sort of an advice and consent, not necessarily disapproval, but an advice with hopefully some sort of a constructive consent. Now, we can do that by making certain that we have someone at all of these meetings or at the pertinent meetings when you start establishing the public input for the process, like any other public member, we can do that. I was just trying to elevate the legislature on a little higher ground, and you don't have to, there's nothing specific, I'm just asking that you think about this and contemplate if there is any validity to that request.
Well, let me suggest first some things come to mind. First, that the legislature could have a representative on the Public Advisory Council. That would be, I'm certain, acceptable to the trustees. No question about that. That's easy. Number one, I've also thought that the legislature can act by way of joint or concurrent resolutions. And if it has a representative a board, as it were, then it can bring that information back, and the legislature, by resolution, can suggest to the trustees that we should pursue these projects.
The intent of the legislature.
Yes, yes. I mean, like I say, I think the political process will work. And let me say something else, because I want everyone to really understand it. I realize the problems, you know, which you might say now develop as a result of this settlement. I wasn't oblivious to all of this. And I thought, you know, as we discussed and negotiated the agreement, that let us present it to the legislature so they would have a voice in this process and the settlement, and hopefully limit the problems. It was a desire to get the subject matter before the legislature that led to the insertion of that provision into the agreement.
Representative Hudson, had you completed? I have Representative Kabita.
A little follow-up on his original question, Attorney General. I think yesterday you made a very compelling argument for getting a settlement. And I don't disagree with you one iota. I do disagree, though, somewhat in the terms of the settlement, that I think we should have gotten a little more, did a little better in those settlements. Mr. Hudson's question, Representative Hudson's question earlier said, could we, in essence, approve this with the stipulation of an amendment. And let me give you a different example. Could we approve this with the stipulation that the $900 million is paid up front today, in today's dollars, and then therefore the legislature would approve if that was done? And what would be the ramifications of that?
I was asked that question yesterday in the Senate hearing, and I answered that I did not think it would be possible, A, to receive the $900 million, and B, I also did not think that it would be possible to receive a discounted present value payment in that fashion. So, but I'm not sure really what that would add anyway if you look at the basic problems of state and federal funds lumped together. I mean, you know, let me say this so everybody understands. I mean, we were negotiating with the United States of America. You know, I mean, just look at the statutes which they, you know, dump on the state of Alaska and other states, and look at the power they wield, and look at the power the Secretary Lujan wields over the state. Didn't have anything to do with this settlement, I'm quick to say, but what I'm saying is, I mean, here are these federal statutes, and here are these constitutional provisions, and, you know, and here's the Great White Father out there. And, you know, we battled him here to, you know, a standoff, as it were, 50-50 partners. I mean, I don't think it's possible for anybody, anytime, to do better than that in this environment.
Let me clarify my question. I'm saying we approve the settlement, all those other things. Still, that trust is there. But that the dollar figure, we go back to Exxon and say, we've got everything approved, but state of Alaska state legislature says, you know, that's done, that money ought to be paid up front, and look at, you guys can bite that bullet and do it, and you're out from under it.
Well, I would want to have my earmuffs on when I pose that question to you.
Other questions?
What's that mean?
Well, you know, I used to have a client at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he'd get mad at me, and he'd call, and he would rage for about a half an hour. And it was always late in the day, and I would hold the phone out here like this until I stopped talking because I could tell by the volume. And then I would say anything else, and then I'd hold it back out, and then I'd go to the bar.
But I would suggest to you that...
And I'm just saying that I think that would be the process that would occur if I were to make that suggestion. Thank you.
I would suggest to you, though, that it may be that if you don't have a choice, and they look upon you as coming here in good faith and arguing this, and we rebuffed you on one small little area there.
Sure.
That you're able to go back, and then they would have the final decision. They would say to themselves, well, here we are. Are we going to go to court for 10 years, or are we going to take their last, best, and final offer? It may put you in a stronger bargaining position.
Well, let me ask this, suggest this. You know, if legislature really thought that the criminal case was the lever which brought Exxon to the settlement table, then you'd have to say, wouldn't you, that this is a great settlement? I mean, isn't that the logic? I think it is. So I might say, could we have achieved this settlement without the criminal case? If your underlying thesis is correct, one have to ask oneself that question.
I have Representative Navarro, but before I turn it over to him, I have a question or two. I see several different possible scenarios here, that not all of which have been explored yet by this committee, but just one representative's view, and this isn't a question as much as a brief statement. But I think we have more options than we have really explored here, and
I can assure you we will explore those options before rendering our report, Mr. Attorney General. And I, too, have had clients who have the telephone itis. So I'm with you on that one.
I got a little deaf in one ear to tell you the truth, and I suspect that's the reason.
This is a question from the staff, and I think it's an important question, too. If the Alaska Supreme Court decides this is unconstitutional, provisions in the agreement here, or if another court, whatever court, decides it's unconstitutional, how can we recover against Exxon since we're dismissing our claims?
Well, we have a pending lawsuit against Exxon that arises out of the consent agreement filed in the United States District Court.
Well, let me just ask you the question.
So we'll just go back to the legal trenches and litigate.
So the answer to my question.
That's a question.
Maybe I can clarify. If the problem is that
The record should reflect Ms. Findley is asking a question. Why don't you grab a stray mic?
Here,
one. The record should reflect Representative Hudson was referring to Representative Navarre in a bad point.
If the constitutional problems arise in a sense because of provisions of the Clean Water Act, which I think would probably only apply to the dedication funds. And the point being, well, you can't sue under the Clean Water Act. All you've got is a Clean Water Act case, but you have meanwhile dismissed the state claim, the state case, which does not have a specific dedication. That's what I foresee as the danger.
There's a pending lawsuit against Exxon. It filed in the United States District Court. We simply amend our complaint. Leave to amend should be freely granted, those quote.
So that it would not be under the Clean Water Act? We
sue them under any theory that you want to sue them under. All the existing claims would, in my view, still exist.
I have Representative Navarre.
Yeah, on page 12 of the consent decree. At the end of paragraph 11A, it says Exxon should have no liability to any person or entity, including the government, by reason of undertaking cleanup work performed in accordance with directions of the federal on-scene coordinator or the state on-scene coordinator. And I guess my question is this. Does that mean that if there are third-party claims that the state or the federal governments are then liable? And also, is this consistent with current state law? Can you, in a consent decree, override or eliminate or make null any state statute that currently would be applicable?
This sentence was the subject of focused discussion and negotiation. Exxon's position, I think it's fair to say, generally was, why should we be liable for doing what you told us to do? Made some sense. So we revised the sentence so that we could insert the clause, quote, by reason of undertaking cleanup work, close quote. Those were words chosen advisedly. It means by reason of doing what you asked us to do. And we formulated that language under the Federal Tort Claims Act and under the State Tort Claims Act. And we thought that, in general, Exxon would not be liable for doing what the federal and state governments ask them to do by reason of the discretionary function exceptions to those Tort Claims Act.
we've discussed at length the Dialight case in the United States Supreme Court and another case which is now under advisement on that issue in the United States Supreme Court, argued on behalf of the federal government by Stuart Gerson, who's one of the signatures here. Now, let me say, that has no effect on a breach of contract by Exxon to anyone with whom it may contract in connection with the performance of these functions, has no effect on negligent actions which Exxon may commit in the course of its work, just in that one narrow area, and it was very carefully drafted with your concerns in mind.
So when you say no liability, that means no liability under certain, I guess, restrictions or definitions?
They have no liability for exceeding to the directions of the federal on-scene coordinator that says, go clean up this beach and do the following. And they're protected by going to clean up that beach. If they, in the performance of that duty, in my view, they negligently injure someone's property, real or personal, then they're liable for that. And they're liable for, you know, workman's compensations, injuries to their employees and things like that, only in that narrow function.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And from a legal standpoint, when it says Exxon should have no liability, it doesn't say Exxon has no liability.
It's true. That was carefully chosen, too. I mean, we waffled a little there, didn't we? Not shall, should. And that was another word that we chiseled out of.
So that whether or not they should, they may still, under current applicable law.
Yes, we gave them what's sort of known as cold comfort.
Thank you.
Certainly. Another question from the staff. Referring to the clause that Representative Navarre has been discussing, absent this sentence, why would Exxon have been liable for undertaking the cleanup?
Why would they have been for undertaking it? They probably would have been relieved from liability under the Federal Tort Claims Act, discretionary function exception. Obviously they wanted more than what they got. They wanted a lot more, but we didn't give it to them. We just said, look, you can have a little bit of cool comfort because we think that under the Tort Claims Act, you don't have liability. And, you know, we let it go with that. They wanted more. You know, we really did negotiate fairly well in some areas.
Just to follow up, since this was Ms. Finley's question, let her ask a question, then Representative Kabina.
I think I would understand this better. I think I understand what you're saying. I would understand why the clause was in there a little better if I understood what legal theories you would sue Exxon for merely the decision to decide to take over cleanup.
No, they wanted protection from third parties out there.
What would the third parties be suing them for?
Tearing up their beach.
Trespass?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, I don't mean to say flippantly sure, but I mean that's an example of the sort of thing they wanted protection from, absolute protection. They wanted indemnification, and we said no. And we discussed, told them we wouldn't give them indemnification, and we told them that we thought the Federal and State Tort Claims Acts were applicable, and that was all they were going to get.
Mr. Chairman, Attorney General, did we want more? And if so, what? What more did we want out of this agreement that we didn't get?
Oh, we wanted $1.2 billion cash.
Well, you see, you gave me indications yesterday that you settled the money issue very easily.
Early.
Because the reason I brought that up last time, being an old teacher negotiator here, is that's usually the last issue you settle in teacher contracts, because I'm not a
high-priced, high-powered lawyer. And
I'm not high-priced.
Not anymore. Not anymore.
Well, what did we want?
Well,
that we didn't get, that we actually fought hard for.
You want me to go through every sentence in here?
So maybe,
let me be right up front.
Okay. Why did we talk about the numbers first?
We spent weeks, let me say maybe a week or 10 days under the reopener clause itself. That was early on. But we fought, you might say fought, that's too strong a term, but we negotiated very pointedly over virtually every sentence in this agreement, and in many instances, every word. You know, in a reopener clause, I mean, there were grand battles about whether you just to tell you where they were mentioned, what you didn't get. You know, on page 18 in subsection A, the cost of a restoration project must not be grossly disproportionate to the magnitude of the benefits anticipated from remediation. First, there was an insertion of the cost of the benefits, which caused a huge storm and brouhaha, which went on and off for days. Rather, you should really factor in the cost of. And finally, Richard Stewart, in his usual abilities, finally said, well, why don't we just put the word magnitude in?
I think that the question relates to the major points.
But let me just get back. Well, I'm saying one of the major discussions, one of the major issues was that reopener clause. Did we want a bigger cap on the reopener? Yes, we wanted a bigger cap on the reopener. The state, in the persona of me, said we want a much bigger recap on the reopener. And I did not agree. Just say this. I wanted a bigger cap. I took it down to where there was a federal representative thought I was going to topple the whole agreement, you know, on that cap. But I finally acquiesced, but it was a huge argument, and it was early on. Now, let me just hit the high points. We wanted $1.2 billion cash. We didn't get $1.2 billion cash. We wanted a reopener clause. We got a reopener clause. Did we get all we wanted out of the reopener clause? Most of what we wanted out of the reopener clause, okay? Did we want to release Ilyeska from the natural resource damage claims? No. Charlie Gold said, hold that card till the very end. Didn't give up, but it was tough. Why did we discuss these at the outset? Well, why spend, you know, 5 weeks arguing all these things and get down to the and then say, well, we can't reach a court on the dollars? Because I think it was the general view that if you can't reach a court on the dollars, we should go home. And I still think that was right, rather than go to the end. So, you know, we wanted more cash, a bigger total payment. We wanted it in cash. We also obviously negotiated at length over how much was paid each year under the installments. We wanted it to the extent we could front-end loaded. We got it somewhat front-end loaded, as you see. We wanted it front-end loaded because heavier expenses, in a sense, front-end loaded. We wanted that. You know, and then you can start down the long trail following that.
I'd like to move fairly
quickly as we're moving right along here and invite members as they have additional questions. We spent a considerable amount of time on trying to hit some of the highlights, letting the committee move away from the list, and that certainly in accord with my intent in the future here. Yes.
I do have one. My very first question was, would it be possible for the legislature to approve this with stipulations? And I think I hear your answer is no. You approve it as it's written, or you disapprove it. Is that correct understanding, Mr. Attorney General?
Yes. But just so the record is clear, that's not to say we can't disapprove it with stipulations.
But I'm just looking for the gentleman's understanding of what we can and can't do under those purposes.
I want you. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I never do, Max.
to paraphrase Paul Newman, I think what we have here.
Paul Newman.
The failure.
Mr. Chairman, yes. I think maybe what the Attorney General may be saying is he certainly doesn't want us to. But I'm not sure that he is really here to tell us that we can't do that. If we passed a resolution that said, we approve this document with the following changes, what would you do?
Well, let me get my position clear, because I think you didn't quite accurately state it, if I say so myself. Personally, Charlie Cole, personally, Fairbanks resident, I have no interest one way or the other in this settlement, number one. Charlie Cole, Attorney General, I believe this agreement is in the best interest of the state, acting as Attorney General and acting as a public trustee, and I think it should be approved. I am not here in any form or fashion, publicly once, to tell the legislature what to do or even to suggest what it do, other than I would like to see it approve this document for the reasons I've mentioned. And the legislature can do what it well wishes to do. I understand that. But what do I think the effect of the legislature doing those things would be? I think it would sink the settlement. And I think we would head down the path of interminable litigation, which I certainly will not be around to wind up, or I suspect ever again have the opportunity to negotiate a settlement. I mean, that's my view, and I'm unemotional about it. I recognize the political process and how it works. And what you people decide to do is certainly within your entire ambit.
Thank you, Mr. Trader.
Moving ahead here.
Slowly.
Well, the wheels of justice grind exceedingly fine.
That's my point.
Alaska's question 17. Alaska's constitution vests the appropriation power in the legislature alone. Federal laws and regulations applicable to the Clean Water Act require the governor to appoint a trustee who will decide how money recovered under the CWA is to be spent. Is the scheme under the CWA contrary to Alaska's constitution? And if so, does the AG have the power to enter into an agreement under the CWA? Now, I know you're going to cite us to your memorandum once again. Is there anything you'd like to add to that?
No, I'm exhausted.
I think that we may have more energy than you at this point.
Well, more of you, that's the reason.
You hold your own just fine, Terry.
Question 18, and we'll be coming back to some of these, I'm sure. How much has the state spent for response, cleanup, damage assessment, and litigation costs?
Let me give you a number, if you don't mind. Can I have a second?
Of course. Oh, yes. You indicated that last time we met that you would be hopeful to give us a summary of this, a written report. Have you had an opportunity to do that yet?
Sure. There it is. That may be
Maybe we could get this
semi-confidential. I don't know, but maybe it isn't.
How do we duplicate that? And if you duplicate that, and we'll come back to question 18 here.
But let me say, you know, there may be a slight variation in those numbers. I'm not an accountant.
We will come back to that question here in a minute, as soon as the duplication is there. Question 19, and I consider this a very important and key question. To what extent would the legislature's approval of the consent decree constitute an approval of the MOA? And I think that I'm going to expand on that question a bit.